Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Faith Radio Mornings. This is Martin Luther King Jr. Day all around our country, and we're going to celebrate that on our show today. I am your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we are going to jump right in because we got a lot to cover in hour one. Up first is our good friend Justin Gibney. We had a great interview with him last week, and we're going to replay that at the start of the show, and then we will listen to a great clip from the I Have a Dream speech at the bottom of this hour. So stay tuned for lots to come here on Faith Radio Mornings. God of mercy, sweet love of mine, I have surrendered to your design. May this offering stretch across the sky. Please, hallelujah, be more. Just about 10 minutes past the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we're joined at this time by Justin Gibney of the AND Campaign. Justin's a regular contributor, not just to the morning show, but he's on the Faith Radio Network often talking about ways in which we can approach politics from a kingdom standpoint. Good morning, Justin.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Well, it's going pretty well. A little chilly, a little dark here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but, you know, the sun will come up. I'm assuming it'll – are you in Atlanta right now?
I am.
So did the sun come up already in Atlanta? You got to give me some measure of hope here, Justin.
Oh, yeah, it's shining bright.
I love it. Well, thanks for joining us. I know one of the topics that's top of the mind these days is obviously the ongoing rancor and the division in Washington, D.C. And you released an article titled Graceless Politics, in which you're inviting people to maybe think about a different way besides all the bluster and the back and forth power over kinds of dynamics that are part of Washington, D.C. Take our listeners through a bit of your thinking in this.
Yeah, well, as you stated, our politics right now are really hostile. And I think people are under the misconception that somehow hostility and acting toward, you know, uncivil and using different sorts of language is actually more effective than being more gracious. And so really what I argue in the article is that, especially for Christians, there is always a time for grace in these conversations. And in fact, grace is actually more effective. The incivility and the nastiness is actually a lot of times it's counterproductive.
And we see some of the invitations even from the biblical text, things like a gentle answer turns away wrath. And we see about Jesus saying things like bless those who curse you. Is there some of this that breaks the cycle, Justin? Because it calls to mind Martin Luther King Jr. talking with this great quote when he says, hate begets hate, violence begets violence, toughness begets a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love, or else we descend into a void that or a darkness that's void of the stars. And I think about that I hardly ever know of a situation, whether it's in a friendship or in a marriage or in politics, in a business, anything, where you see some of this hate where it just ends anywhere good unless somebody's willing to break that cycle.
Yeah, hatred is infectious. And I think the civil rights movement taught us that, and we've seen it throughout history. We obviously see it in the Bible, that hate is infectious, and that instead of being a carrier of that hate, that we should try to change things. Now, I want to be clear. This doesn't mean that we let oppressors go, or we let people who are doing wrong go. That's not what this is saying at all. But in how we address it, because certain things have to be addressed, this is not saying that we should shy away from issues at all. But it's saying there is a certain way for Christians to address things. Ephesians 4:15 says we should speak the truth in love. And so as we tell the truth, as we address oppression and discrimination, where they may be, we have to do it in a certain way, and that should be with grace.
Well, and in terms of looking back to the 2015-2016 election cycle, agree or disagree with the president's policies, agree or disagree with policies on more the Democratic side of it, I think we can safely say that Donald Trump introduced something into the political atmosphere that was of a different degree and a different caliber in terms of sort of the nastiness. And you write in your article, Graceless Politics, that embracing the spirit of the commander-in-chief is perhaps overestimating what can be accomplished by responding to nastiness in kind. What I read on Twitter from our politicians these days, Justin, it makes my hair stand on end at sometimes, and we're certainly getting used to it a little bit in terms of the level of discourse.
Yeah, it seems that we value the witty comeback more than we do the solution. And so people want retweets. We want to see our leaders say something mean to humiliate the other side. But if we think about that, humiliating the other side is extremely counterproductive. Not only does it make it less likely that you'll be able to work with them to get something done, but all you're doing is making hardening the hearts of the people on your side as well. And so at the end of the day, well, I can have a serious conversation and call people out when necessary. To be focused on humiliating the other side and getting retweets because I had the strongest comeback while people are sitting at home and the government is closed and I haven't done anything to stop that, I think it's irresponsible, but I think it starts with us. It starts with the people. Politicians, a lot of them, let's just face it, they seek attention. And if we don't give them attention for those type of negative things, they may stop doing it. And so I would tell people, stop retweeting, stop chatting up or talking about those people who are trying to get attention through doing it the wrong way. Talk about those people who are actually putting policy forth, who are really working on getting things done instead of those who are always talking. And, you know, a lot of our politicians are better commentators than they are policymakers, and that needs to stop.
Yeah, you make such an important point because I think the greatest fear perhaps of any politician is not being in the news. And so regardless of whether you're in the news for positive or negative reasons, there's this desire to be in that news cycle.
Yeah, for sure. And it's sort of like my children, right? Children want attention. And so sometimes if they can get it through doing something positive, they'll do it that way. If they can get it through doing things that are negative, they'll get it that way, any way they can get it. And we need to treat it that way and say, no, we're not going to reward negative behavior or behavior that further damages our discourse.
Well, and one of the things that we can do, Justin, is look back and learn from the events of history when things were maybe effective as something that somebody did that really did change the trajectory. And you tell a great story from June of 1963 about a woman named Fannie Lou who really was helpful in changing some of the trajectory of the Jim Crow era.
Oh, yeah. Well, Fannie Lou Hamer is a civil rights legend. And I would recommend that everyone listening today go read up on Fannie Lou Hamer. We talk a lot about Dr. King, and especially in this month and the next couple of days, as we should. I'm actually reading a book on Dr. King as we right now. But Fannie Lou Hamer, in a lot of ways, really embodied the civil rights movement almost even more than Dr. King did just through her life. And one of the things that she went through is that she was beaten. She was in the South kind of doing training to demystify the political process to Southern blacks who had never been able to vote, who had been disenfranchised. Well, in the midst of doing that, she was pulled over. She was beaten senselessly. And after all that happened, the police officer ended up getting off. She was actually fined for the incident, although she did nothing wrong. One of her friends asked her, what do you think about the people who did this to you? I mean, what do you have to say? And her response was, we have to pray for them. They're sick. And if we're going to be the physician, then we have to pray for them and we kind of have to rise above what's happened. And that, I think, is the moral of the story when it comes to the civil rights movement. This didn't stop her from fighting. She fought and continued to fight the struggle day in and day out. But she knew that at the end of the day, as a Christian, she had to do it with grace and that everyone was broken. And everyone needed to be forgiven. That didn't mean they didn't need to be held accountable, but she did have to forgive. And I think that's a lesson we could all learn.
Yeah, I think it's such an important thing that you're suggesting is that to offer grace and forgiveness does not mean we're not holding people responsible or a lack of accountability. And if somebody is a victim of injustice in any kind of situation, Justin, I would think a first blush response is to not respond in prayer. What's sort of required for a person to enter into that kind of character? It almost feels otherworldly in my mind.
It's completely otherworldly. It's not logical, and so we shouldn't expect a lot of other people to get it. But I think it is a matter of prayer. It's a matter of being as close to the cross and understanding the life of Jesus as much as possible to get to a place where you understand that the ultimate victory isn't here. The ultimate victory is beyond, and you are here, number one, not to win something, but you are here to have a witness that is worthy of, you know, of what the Father and doing the Father's business. And so at the end of the day, no, we don't just accept whatever goes down here. We try to do what we can do to make things better, to serve justice and to do justice. But we have to keep in mind that there are greater things than what's here on earth.
Yeah, such an important reminder. Boy, it's living out of a different kingdom, and that isn't always easy to do. We're talking with Justin Gibney this morning of the AND campaign, and we'll come back in just a minute, Justin. Some pretty troubling comments out of a congressman in Iowa, Steve King, that happened here recently, and I want to get your perspective on what he said about white supremacy here next on Faith Radio Mornings. Minutes past the hour here in Faith Radio Mornings. We are talking with Justin Gibney of the AND campaign about ways in which we can inject maybe a bit of grace in our conversations in the political sphere. And Justin, some troubling comments coming out of a congressman out of Iowa here in the last few days, in which Steve King said these words. He said, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive? Gee, Justin, it's hard to understand why that would be offensive.
Yeah, unfortunately, this isn't the first time Steve King has said things like this. And so I think it's incumbent, especially coming from a minority point of view, I think it's incumbent on Christians who are on the Republican side of the spectrum to really call this out. I mean, this is the time when you say, you know what, we have to make sure that we are clear that we do not condone this type of thing, because it's been going on for too long. And I'm glad some folks have stepped up and said something about it. But Steve King has been, very close to words like this many times before, and it's unfortunate that he's just getting called out now.
Yeah, and to your point, there is an accountability level that needs to be in place, even if we do and as we do respond in grace and love. And it was refreshing to see Mitt Romney say yesterday some things about holding him accountable.
Well, Steve King's comments are reprehensible. They have no place in polite society, certainly no place in the Republican Party. And they should have no place in the United States Congress. He ought to resign and move on and let someone else who represents American values take his seat.
And of course, I think we can fairly say, Justin, that part of what motivates these sorts of comments is a recognition that the Republican Party is going to alienate a lot of people if they don't respond. But in the past, there hasn't been a lot of response that really condemns these kind of remarks.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think there's an understanding that there is part of the base who doesn't have a problem with this. I mean, he said it for a reason. He probably said it because it ignites a certain group of people. And so this is when political calculations need to go out the window. When things like this happen, the reason that both sides get in trouble is because we have political calculations and we're thinking about who may be offended. If the only reason that we're saying something about this is because we may offend more people if we don't, then that's problematic. We should say something about it because it's wrong. And until we can get to that point, especially as Christians, because I can't speak to everyone else's values in the same way, especially as Christians, when it comes to principle, when it comes to people being treated fairly and basically human dignity, there should be no political calculation. We have to do what's right.
Well, and Justin, you work in the political sphere quite a bit throughout any given week, and I'm assuming that it would be refreshing if we would hear more kinds of comments that don't involve political calculation, but it does seem like everything is messaged, you know, time and time and time again before it ever gets out into public.
Oh, absolutely. And as being a political strategist, I completely understand that. But once again, I'm going to put the onus on us. What are we going to incentivize? What standard are we going to hold our officials to? And are we going to wait for their political calculations? Are we going to call them out when we see them making political calculations that put them in a bad situation or again hurt our discourse? I was glad to hear that I think he's being removed from some committees and things of that nature. The best thing for him to do would be to apologize and resign.
And Justin, think about the invitations for pastors in this situation. I know I was in pastoral ministry for a number of years, and one of the tensions that pastors, I think, often deal with their constituency and their parishioners is wondering, can they talk about politics from the pulpit? Should they even engage? Because being part of the kingdom of Jesus involves a different set of transcendent eternal values that sometimes intersect with politics and sometimes don't. But is this situation an opportunity to really highlight what we've been talking about all morning and the idea of, in all forms, learning how to meet hate and learning how to meet division with love and grace and some of these concepts of the kingdom?
It does present an opportunity. And, you know, I'm not one of those people that says everything that happens in politics that's negative that a pastor must preach on it. That's not the first thing they need to preach about. So I'm hesitant to tell them what to preach about. But certainly we should understand that intersection. And when the opportunity arises and there's a clear violation of Christian principle, I think that's a good opportunity for a pastor to speak out and say, here's what we believe, and here's why this is unacceptable based on biblical principles.
And Justin, we have just about a minute left here. I'm curious your thoughts, too. If people begin to engage in the kind of process in which they begin to refuse meeting hate with hate or violence with violence, and they attempt to meet such things with grace and love and forgiveness, that doesn't just automatically mean that the response of the oppressor, the perpetrator of the violence, is suddenly going to become positive. How do you stay in that journey for the long term, continuing to offer grace and forgiveness when there isn't change on the other side?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a commitment to being faithful to doctrine, right? I think it's, you know, as an Orthodox Christian, I think that comes with orthopraxy. And so it's not really a choice. Number one, I do have to respond to injustice, and I have to do it in a certain way. And if I'm going to be faithful, if I'm going to be, you know, have fidelity within the public square, then I have to address things with grace. Number two, and second to that, which is this is very much secondary, is that, again, responding with vitriol and all those things is not as productive as we think it is. I actually think that it's counterproductive. So as a Christian, you have to stay prayerful. You have to stay reading the Bible so you can keep perspective. And as long as you keep perspective, you will be able to have grace as you go about very serious political situations, holding people accountable, but remembering that we all deserve grace.
Well, Justin, certainly appreciate what you do to carving out space for kingdom values in the midst of the Republican and Democrat debates, and just continue to pray for your work and what you're up to, and thanks for your wisdom and insight this morning.
Thanks for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
We'll head to Lighten Up and some bottom of the hour news next here on our Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Faith Radio Mornings. Safe to say that the I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King Jr. is the best known speech that we've ever heard in our country, one that's been replayed millions of times, so worth listening to. And as you're thinking about how to celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day today and the life and legacy that he had, it's worth spending about 17 minutes of your day just listening to the entirety of the speech, the level of discourse, the level of promise, the level of hope, so different than so often the dialogue of our day among politicians. So we thought on Faith Radio Mornings here this morning, we would take a couple minutes to just listen to a segment of that, one of the most famous parts of the speech, actually, in which he begins to articulate the dream that he has.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Every time I listen to that, I just begin to tear up a little bit. It's such a powerful and potent dream that is so consistent with the kingdom of God and a way in which our country can come together with the principles of the kingdom. So up next here on Faith Radio Mornings, we'll be joined by Ruth Kramer of Mission Network News, and we'll talk about some of the headlines around the world and the impact that so many of the troubling spots in our world are having on our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ.
Nearly 200 nations on earth. Why is Israel, which is one of the tiniest, consistently in the national news? This is Jim Garlow. Well, for starters, God had a pretty strong statement to say all of us. He said, "Bless Israel, and I'll bless you. Curse Israel, and you finish the sentence. It won't be good." On top of that, he made promise after promise that he would, after he had scattered Israel, he would regather Israel. Now, there are some who follow what's called replacement theology. Replacement theology is basically kind of sophisticated anti-Semitism that says, Israel, you just don't count anymore. God's not committed to that piece of real estate. But that's not true based on what's happening in Israel. God is honoring his word in the Bible, and he's regathering that nation, miraculously reestablishing it after a couple thousand years in 1948, and then continuing day by day to fulfill scripture in Israel right now. Be well-versed at jimgarlow.com.
Back to Faith Radio Mornings, and delighted to be joined by good friend and regular contributor to our show, Ruth Kramer of Mission Network News, who joins us regularly to talk about some of the experiences believers are having around the world and some of the headlines that we see that I may not always totally understand what's happening. Ruth does such a great job of getting us into the information of those different scenes. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
So one of the events here in the last couple of weeks, actually last week that we saw, was the really difficult situation out of Nairobi, in which we saw a bombing, a terrorist attack, in which a lot of people lost their lives. And as we're sort of dealing with the fallout now of that, Ruth, what are some things that we need to understand about who did this and what happened and what we see moving forward in that country?
Yeah, okay. Let me just kind of bring us up to date on where we are on this particular situation. The siege ended 20 hours after it began, so it's all over with. But there's still a lot of questions that remain, and there's justice issues. Police were already looking for the masterminds, the people who are behind the attack, and they have in custody between 9 and 11. The reason we have differing numbers is just because these stories are still unfolding, and so as we see another couple of days pass, you may have an even more firm number or more arrests being made with this particular situation. I think the thing that we can say about this particular attack and Al-Shabaab being the extremist group behind it is that it's reminding people of all of the other attacks that they have committed on Kenyan soil. And this is something where Kenya is considered one of the more settled, one of the more developed nations in Africa. So for them to be dealing with this kind of thing with basically the wild, wild west of Somalia, although Somalia is on the other side, this is kind of unsettling to Kenyans. They're not strangers to this kind of activity. In 2013, you had the siege on Westgate Mall. I'm sure you can remember just multiple images and stories that were coming up with Al-Shabaab attacking the mall, which is kind of in a highly trafficked tourist area. You might call it an upscale area where a lot of expats were going to be staying and touring and vacationing and shopping. And so this was the target that Al-Shabaab really wanted to hit to make a point, a statement, about what they wanted to accomplish. It was bloody. It was really horrible. And it rattled Kenya. It's one area, you know, of all of the different things, but it was in the financial district. So Kenya really felt the impact of this attack. And then a couple years later, the Al-Shabaab militants crossed over the border in Garissa and attacked a university there and killed 140 some odd students and faculty and staff members, most of whom were Christians. They targeted the Christians. So again, this is a situation where Kenya has embraced its Christian community. And now you're not only attacking the religious minority, you are also attacking their children. And so Al-Shabaab has really kind of created a name for themselves that is rattling people with this current attack. What does Al-Shabaab want? That is one question that we get asked a lot by people who engage with the stories. Al-Shabaab is connected to Al-Qaeda. And so if you know the ideology of extremists like Al-Qaeda, it's going to be very similar to that. They want to create a caliphate. They are against anything that doesn't agree with their ideology. And in this case, this particular attack, they said they perpetrated as a protest on the U.S.'s stance on opening the embassy in Jerusalem. But it's also targeting Christians. It's also targeting anything they consider from the West because it's considered foreign. So it's not an unusual kind of thing if we've been following the situation with Al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremists. The thing also that is interesting is Al-Shabaab can't agree within itself. So now you've had a group of people who don't feel like Al-Qaeda is, I guess, enough of a strict adherent to the Salafist kind of a thinking and the approach to Islam. And so you've had a splinter group that's kind of identifying themselves with the Islamic State within Al-Shabaab. And they're kind of hunting each other down at this point. So you've got a lot of chaos that's going on. Somalia being their home ground, Somalia is kind of a failed state. So there's really nobody reining these guys in. And now they're just running amok. So will we see more of this kind of stuff? Unfortunately, the answer is probably yes. There are a lot of ministries that have their headquarters in Nairobi. And they're just basically saying, we're going to keep on doing what we're going to do because God has called us here. But ask God to give us wisdom as we go out and about and do our things. Pray for courage, because when you see buildings exploding and you know Al-Shabaab is in the neighborhood, it gives you pause. You know, they're normal people. They're not superhuman people who are just completely without fear. They get affected by these things too. And when the whole area is covered by kind of a miasma of fear, it does permeate. It does affect people. So be praying for boldness, be praying for creative wisdom, and be praying that, that Christ would reveal himself to these Al-Shabaab militants, that, that he would transform hearts, because we do have stories of that happening. We've had stories of complete transformation of Islamic State fighters, of Al-Qaeda fighters, of Al-Shabaab fighters, of people who belong to Boko Haram coming to Christ because he revealed himself to them.
Yeah, Ruth, I so appreciate your perspective and just sort of the knowledge that you have about this, because I confess that I'm sort of prone to just kind of lump all of the terror groups that I read about in the headlines into the sort of the same category. But there really is differences and factions between all of them. And one thing I'd be curious to get your perspective on, too, is how does some of these terror attacks further the goals of these groups? From the outside looking in, it just seems like it's kind of this mindless attack. Is it an ability to gain visibility, which then gains followers, which then from there gains some power? Or how does this work?
Well, you know, this is uncomfortable to admit. The Islamic State really knows how to market themselves.
Mm-hmm. They do.
They just claim credit for horrible things. They do things that have high shock value, and it makes them seem much more dangerous and much scarier and much bigger than they may actually be. I mean, I'm not saying that the violence isn't horrific. I'm not saying that what they have done isn't awful, because it is. But I think that they're capitalizing on that, which is actually the definition of terror, to make people so afraid that they just, you know, run around in mindless panic. And the governments that are dealing with these insurgencies are saying, we are going to get after these guys. We're going to bump up security. We're going to do everything we can to keep you safe, because they're trying to counter the whole message of terror. So groups like Al-Shabaab, their main focus when they're trying to do something, they'll give you a reason for it, and they'll say, yes, we want to create a caliphate. They're coming from a woolly and wild segment of their country that has high poverty, that has no functioning government, that has basically the guy who's leading is the strongest warlord. And so they're taking all of those kinds of things, throwing some ideology over the top of it and going wherever they want to go, and making a statement. They're doing horrific things to kind of put themselves on the map and say, hey, we're part of this too. Take us seriously. And, you know, I think what you would find is that if the goal of all of these terror organizations is to go back to a place where you have a caliphate, that's fantastic for them in terms of having a goal. But the reality is they will never, ever, ever be able to agree to cooperate and hand leadership over to a single caliph. It's not going to happen. So whatever they're saying and they're claiming as their goal of creating the caliphate, of, you know, going against or removing the foreign influences or the evil things from the West or the pollution from the Christian ideology or whatever it is that they are saying, it's just a very surface kind of a message, because when you really dig a little bit deeper underneath that, it's just kind of a chaos that they're trying to introduce. Because at the heart of things, you know, when you get into some of the deeper Islamic State ideology, there is chaos involved with it. There is terror involved with it. They're trying to usher in the end of the world.
Great stuff, Ruth. Love the segment. Just love the insight into that. Let's take a short break and we come back. I need to get your perspective on some of what we've seen from the Ministry Open Doors as they released their World Watch List. We won't be able to get into everything there, but I want to get your take on a few of the highlights of what we see there. So more to come with Ruth Kramer from Mission Network News next on Faith Radio Mornings. For me, is a very helpful conversation with Ruth Kramer of Mission Network News. And if you want to go see some of Ruth's work, you can go to mnnonline.org. Ruth does such a great job of covering these complex topics and make it digestible for people like me. I feel empowered, Ruth, to just sort of understand so many of these dynamics that seem so far away and yet really touch us as believers. So thank you for that work. And I know that you follow closely the Ministry Open Doors and their World Watch List. What do we see coming out of that? Just some touch points that you've noticed so far.
Well, you know, every time I look at the World Watch List and its release, you keep hoping there's going to be something different, something like that they can say like, well, you know, it's going to be a great year for all the Christians in the world. And that's just not going to happen. And every year they come out and say, it's going to get worse, you know, and then you look at everything, you're like, well, yeah, it's probably going to get worse until the Lord comes back.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're seeing here. I mean, what they're saying is, looking at the numbers and all of the things that they've compiled over the course of their research here, is that 245 million Christians in the top 50 countries on the World Watch List are expected to face some kind of level, high level of persecution in the coming year. And that is up like 30 million people from last year.
Wow.
So we've seen some movement in the list, that some of it is a little bit of a surprise, some of it's not. I think two things that they highlighted, actually three countries that they're bringing some attention to. One of them is Russia, and it's kind of a regression back to, I want to say, pre-Iron Curtain days. That might be a little bit too free with that terminology, but I'll try to explain that later. And the other part of it involves two of the most populous countries in the world, and that is China and India. Those two countries, that we've seen a lot of things kind of shifting and moving, and it's not making it easier for people to be openly followers of Christ. I think you've seen a lot of stories within the last couple of months, even November, December, early January, where China was starting to crack down on a number of above ground churches, registered churches, as well as the underground churches. When you follow what's going on with the body of Christ in China, seeing pressure on the underground church, the unregistered churches, isn't unusual. But seeing the government crack down, close buildings, arrest people, rip down crosses on the registered churches has been kind of a new thing, which is also why it's been noted by Open Doors. So, you know, China has made it onto the list of the top 50 countries where it is hardest to be a Christian. But they jumped 16 spots from number 43 last year to number 27 this year. So that is going to be something where we want to be watching even more closely. And one of the things that people ask me when we look at stuff like this is, what can we do about it? Yes, we can get involved with letting our congresspeople know, you know, getting in touch with the ambassador at large for international religious freedom and saying, we want you to put some pressure on China because we want them to know that we are watching this situation. The other thing is to get behind organizations that are vetted, who are doing good work or walking alongside partners in China who know how to do this and keep people safe. So organizations that are persecution watchdogs like Voice of the Martyrs, Open Doors, other organizations, Bibles for China, I'm trying to think, Christian Aid Mission is out there, China Partner is out there, you know, and everybody has a unique place in this kind of work. Some of these ministries work with the above ground church, and some of them work with the underground church. There's a place for both because China's a really big country. And then I think the other thing, too, is watching what's happening with India, because, again, if you've been following anything in what's been happening around the world, you've been noticing a significant increase in the reports of distressed Christians, of people who've been attacked, of, you know, the Hindu nationalists seemingly having no consequences when they do something that would fall under what we would call criminal activity against Christians. So what we've seen is the government in India has become very sympathetic to the Hindu nationalist parties. So BJP, the RSS, those kinds of organizations now have representatives in the top leadership in India. And so pressure is going to be felt by the body of Christ there. So that is not a surprise. But again, this is the first time India has made it into the top 10. And to make it into the top 10, according to Open Doors, you've got to really be doing things that put a lot of pressure on Christians that is they're completely what we would call unfair. Again, it's a situation where a lot of Hindu nationalists feel empowered to do what they're going to do, and they act with impunity. So it's bearing watching. We've seen some laws change in India where it's changing how things can be funded. We've seen some ministries have to leave because there is absolutely no way they can get funds from the U.S. into India because of the change in the finance laws. And so it's affecting ministry there. At the same time, you've got ministries that are working on the ground in India who know how to do this well, who have done it, have been doing it well, and have had experience with the persecution issues, expect it. And they're just kind of flexing with what's happening. It's a hiccup. It's a definite shift. And they're more careful about security because they have to be. But it's not going to stop what they're doing. It hasn't stopped their call to reach the unreached. It has not stopped their call to disciple and to take the gospel to the uttermost parts of the earth. They're still sending out missionaries. It just doesn't affect what they do because they expect it. So, but be in prayer for the body of Christ in India, because we are expecting to see even more things change, even more stuff, put a lot of pressure on Christians there. And the other one is Russia. You know, again, this is kind of one of those things where if you've been following any of the political things that are going on, you know, all of our talks with these countries have become somewhat difficult as of late. And so sometimes the dialogue doesn't get where we want it to go. Sometimes things aren't actually discussed the way we'd like to see them discussed. But what we're hearing about what's happening in the Russian Federation is that they're really putting a lot of pressure on the religious minorities. In Russia, there's favoritism, heavy favoritism towards the Orthodox Church. So there's some measures of protection given to them. So for the non-Orthodox, the people who would be more evangelical, they're the ones who are feeling a lot of the pressure right now. And even though some of the new laws, the religion laws and things like that, were really meant to deal with political issues or to curb extremism, because Russia's also dealing with a Muslim extremist faction. Local authorities, you know, the high authority like the Duma doesn't intend for this to be something where you would call it open persecution. But the local authorities are interpreting a lot of how to implement some of the reading of the codes. And it does come down hard on the non-Orthodox Christian activity. So you're seeing a lot of things being affected, like Christian camps. You're seeing a lot of the VBS programs being affected. Maybe church planting kind of things are being affected, because that falls now afoul of the definition of how people are reading it in the local authority to how to implement it. So what we're seeing right now in terms of an adverse effect The anti-missionary amendment has been used to punish some of the smaller churches. And because they're small already, they're kind of a minority, they don't have a lot of money. They can't really, compete with or meet some of the expectations and standards that are being imposed on them. There's an immigration law, which has been used to target and expel expatriates who use social media to share evangelical messages. And that's another thing we've seen, as well as unregistered churches active in evangelism have faced quite a number of obstructions, and they're reporting a lot of increased surveillance and interrogation. So that's what we're seeing right now. The thing I think is interesting is that when you speak to the Russian Christians and you ask them about these things, because it sounds terrible to us, but when you ask them about this, they will tell you that it is light years better for Christians than in the days behind the Iron Curtain. Their perspective is a little different. And they've been through it before. Their older generation has been through it before, and they will be able to walk alongside the next gen that are the church leaders now and show them the way because our generation has already been through it.
That's phenomenal stuff, Ruth. Your insight into all these topics, I just really appreciate. I know that it's one of the things that comes through our surveys of what listeners are most interested in is the global experience of Christians. And so you're as dialed in as anyone. Again, if you're listening this morning, you can go to mnnonline.com and see all of what Ruth has had to say as part of Mission Network News. Ruth, thanks for taking the time and just giving us some insight on what's happening around the world.
Thanks for having us.
Well, in just a minute, we'll preview what's coming up on Hour 2 here for Faith Radio Mornings on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Enjoyed that first hour of the show. Being joined by Justin Gibney just brings such a great perspective in the work that he's doing, cutting a pathway between some of the divisive Republican and Democratic conversations in our country and really doing politics from a kingdom standpoint. And I think that's so representative of what we're doing here on Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Faith Radio Mornings. And Ruth Kramer always dialed in to the news around the world and the impact that's having on believers. And we have Hour 2 coming up here on Faith Radio Mornings, and we'll be joined first by Dr. Linda Mintel, the relationships expert. And of course, Martin Luther King had this dream that we could all live together in some beautiful ways. And who better to talk about that kind of dynamic with than Linda Mintel? So stay tuned for Hour 2 on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.